Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And good morning, everyone. I hope it's sunshine where you are. It is here.
Sunshine and warm for February.
Yes, I know. 39 degrees.
We're not complaining because a little over a week ago, it had been like 2 weeks straight where it almost never got above zero, certainly not above single digits. And we kind of got used to it, but we like
you
this
got,
better.
Speak for yourself. I never got used to that.
Okay. All right. Well, Mom, tell us about our guest today.
Well, the book today is The Little French Bridal Shop. And it's by, author Jennifer Dupuis. And she is the eldest of a set of fraternal triplets. And she grew up seeking any quiet corner of the house so she could read, write, and work on puzzles. And that reminds me of somebody. And her lifelong passion for old houses inspired Elmhurst, the grand home featured in her debut novel, The Little French Bridal Shop. Now, she was a graduate of Brown University, where she received her honors in creative writing. She is an active member of the Grub Street Writing Company in Boston, community in Boston, and has published in the Feminist Press. She was a semifinalist for the 2016 James Jones First Novel Competition, and a semifinalist for the 2016 Faulkner Wisdom Competition. She lives in a historic house just outside of Boston with her family and is currently at work on her next two novels. Boy, that sounds very good. Okay, welcome to the program.
Yeah, welcome to Writer's Voices, Jennifer.
How wonderful to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us a little bit more about the inspiration behind The Little French Bridal Shop.
Sure. So, you know, writing for me often starts with an image. I'm just a very imagistic writer. In this case, I kind of started with two images, a house and some wallpaper. So I grew up on the North Shore of Boston. My grandmother lived for many years in the small seaside town of Beverly Farms, which is next to Manchester by the Sea of the movie fame. And it's just a setting that's deeply ingrained in my psyche, and I kind of had this vision of a regal house up on a hill there. And I intuited that my main character, Larissa Pearl, had inherited the house. So I had this house in my head, and I had my main character, but I didn't know the story yet. About a year later, I treated myself to a writing weekend in Rockport, Massachusetts, to try to uncover the story behind that house. And I'd just finished breakfast in the dining room and was trying to settle into some meaningful writing, but I kept finding myself distracted by this ridiculous large repeating wallpaper. It was a pattern of these tan pheasants on a navy backdrop. And I couldn't stop laughing. And see, they're sort of peering over their shoulders at each other. And I couldn't stop laughing when I looked at them, and I couldn't stop looking at them. So I began to write the wallpaper into the manuscript. And the story began there with my character, Larissa, taking a crowbar to the house wallpaper in an effort to discover the source of an apparent leak. She's recently purchased a wedding dress on a whim, though she has no groom, and she's grappling with her mother's failing health. And as the novel progresses, she perpetuates that rumor rather than dispel it.
Okay, so that is the oddest thing about this book.
Yeah, it is.
The buying a wedding dress on a whim. Mm-hmm. Have you ever done something like that?
No, I've never done anything like that. But, you know, in this little small town where my grandmother lived, there was a French bridal shop. It was called French Bridals. And when I was in high school, I brought my prom dress there. So somehow when I was kind of embarking on the opening pages of the story, I kind of sent my main character down the hill. And, you know, the bridal shop was in my psyche, I guess. And that's kind of where it came from.
It does seem like a pretty odd thing to do, although I'll admit I do have a friend who I could see doing that, who did something not that differently from that. She actually had two wedding dresses.
Right.
And
you know, in Lewis's
no
case, it's oh, how fun. What a great story. You know, and in Larissa's case, it's almost she walks into the shop and the shopkeeper there kind of makes all these assumptions, you know. Oh, because who would walk into a wedding dress shop without wanting a dress? So the shopkeeper says, oh, my gosh, you're getting married. And she has a ring on her finger that's actually not an engagement ring, but the shopkeeper assumes that it is. And all this kind of gets set in motion, you know. And she thinks, oh, it's kind of a little lie of omission. I won't correct it. But then small town, word spreads all over the small town that she's getting married. You know, kind of small town chaos ensues.
So there's quite a bit going on in this story. You could look at it as a romance, but I feel like the relationship between Larissa and her parents is really in some way the primary relationship in this story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so tell us a little bit about why. You know, you start with the wedding dress. You think this is going to be kind of a traditional romance where things go wrong and everybody ends up happily ever after. But that's not really what the story's about.
No, that's true. So I think of it more of almost like an education plot. So there's a little bit of romance in it, but it's not the crux of the story. I agree with you. You know, as Larissa rips into the wall with the crowbar, she's in a state of kind of disillusionment and confusion. She's not really thinking clearly. You know, in short, she's not quite herself. And I really recognize this state as it was something I deeply felt when I was grappling with my own mother's illness with breast cancer. And as I began to delve into the writing, I realized, you know, Larissa's kind of engaging in more and more deceptions. And her deceptions become a vehicle to explore these feelings of loss of identity and disorientation and confusion that consumes a child, even an adult child who becomes a caretaker of an ailing parent. And for me, that was the crux of the novel. It was really what I wanted to explore. And, you know, I don't think it's a spoiler to say that the mother's struggling with dementia. And obviously, somebody who's dealing with dementia experiences her own loss of identity. But in this case, I wanted to really explore the loss of identity of the daughter.
Now, I noticed in your intro that you are a triplet. And there are a set of triplets in this book, too. Surprise, surprise.
Yes.
So growing up as a triplet must really have a powerful impact on your life.
It does. You know, so, and let me just, you know, just a quick tangent here. Well, first, I never really thought I'd write about being a triplet. It wasn't something that kind of was on my radar. But, you know, as I began to kind of get into the themes of the book, as I said, I realized it was really exploring this idea of identity and what identity means. And I knew that the male character in the book had kids, and I thought, you know, it would be interesting to make them triplets because it really amplifies that theme of identity. And, you know, it's, in my case, when I was born, my parents thought that they were having twins, like literally up until our birth. So I was born first, and my brother was born second. And my father literally said, oh, a boy and a girl, how perfect, what more could we want? And, well, guess what, one more baby. And so they were just thrown into instant family. And it was really fun for us growing up. You know, we each, I think in different stages of our lives, it's been really interesting, right? So for the first 18 years or so before I went off to college, I was with them, you know, most of the time, right, without much time apart. And we each almost had our, we were very interconnected, but we almost, you know, we had sort of our separate identities. Like, I was kind of the writer, my sister was kind of the visual artist, my brother was maybe more theatrical. And then I found it quite interesting when you know, going to college and sort of starting to develop myself as a young adult and really exploring those sides of myself that I thought of sort of their domain. So it was definitely really interesting, as you say.
Oh, so you sort of maybe stayed away from those things when you were younger?
I felt like I did, yeah, and not just sort of hobbies and interests, although, you know, we had some overlap, but personalities. So I was by far the most introverted. My brother was kind of in the middle, and my sister was by far the most extroverted. And I found myself, without them, kind of becoming a little more extroverted than I was, because I kind of had to in situations, right? I wasn't in new situations with them the way I mostly had been, you know?
Oh, good point. Good point. Mm-hmm. So are you still close?
We are, yeah, we are. My brother actually lives almost at the end of my street, so I see him practically every day, which is great. It's like a sitcom, I keep saying. He shows up with a dog at the back door, you know, kind of gets rolled into whatever, you know, chaos is happening at our house. But it's great. And my sister lives on the West Coast. So I'm, as I said, in the Boston area, and she's in the Seattle area. So it's been a bummer that we haven't seen her for a while, but we talk often and we're very close.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. And our guest today is Jennifer Dupuy, author of The Little French Bridal Shop.
I found it interesting that you had this fascination with older houses, and, I imagine that there are a lot of those in Boston, right?
Yes, definitely.
And you live in one now.
We live in one now. So this is also a fun story. When I first started dating my husband, I discovered his love for old houses as well, and we often took neighborhood walks down nearby Elmhurst Road, where we lived at the time, so that we could admire a historic house there. And several years later, not long after we got married, the house went on the market, and we made a bid. And by that time, actually, I had started my novel, and I named the house in the book Elmhurst, as you said in the intro, after, in tribute to this house on Elmhurst Road. So the house went on the market, we made a bid, and unfortunately, we were outbid by other buyers, but the house kind of always stayed in my mind, and even though my fictional house looked really different from the actual house, it was the inspiration. And so during the entire course of writing this novel, we were looking for a house, and, you know, just sort of at the end of finishing a draft, we found a historic house that, you know, was really just what we were looking for. It has, you know, window seats and interesting kind of molding details and just kind of that sense of old bones to it. So, yeah.
And have you tackled renovations the way Larissa did at Elmhurst?
Good question. Not quite the same way, and certainly not myself. Although, you know, in prior years, I had helped. I have some friends who'd bought some old houses, and we had actually ripped into the horsehair plaster and kind of tore out the wall. So that felt a little familiar to me, but not in my own house, although we did do some renovations. So, you know, here in the Northeast and in the Boston area, lots of the wiring, the electrical wiring, is still kind of older knob and tube wiring. So we had to replace all that. And we did a bathroom renovation.
Knob
as well.
And tube?
Yeah,
that's an old
electrical system. Yeah. Oh, gosh. You know, I don't know if I could explain it, but it's essentially the way that the wires are strung through the bones on the inside of the house. So the wires were connected through these little porcelain ceramic knobs, and that's kind of how it's connected. And they're just literally, if you sort of tear down the lathing, you know, behind a wall. You know, we didn't have sheetrock back then. It's kind of like a lathing, and then the structure of the wall behind that, there's these knob and tubes. But the problem is that it can be a fire hazard, because if animals get in or mice start nibbling and they get frayed, they can create a spark. And obviously in an old house with old wood, et cetera, that's not a good situation.
Oh, wow. No, indeed. I think, Monica, I think that they had to change the electrics in our house in Strasbourg before we moved in.
It was probably similar. Yeah. I think that house was, what, late 1700s, maybe?
Probably,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
That was where my childhood in Strasburg, Pennsylvania. So.
Oh, amazing! Yeah.
Yeah. So old houses—they're not quite as old here in Iowa, because they didn't start building them till the late 1800s. Although I lived in a house that, you know, according to the county assessor's records, any house older than a certain amount, they just said it was built in 1900. And
though they weren't all built then.
No, they weren't all built then. So I think that's when my house was showed up as being built. But it had undergone multiple renovations over the years. And I always loved the idea. I didn't do much to it, just mostly outside, you know, gardens and things like that. But closets. I put in a few closets because old houses don't have much in the way
don't
of closets,
have closets,
do they?
It's true.
Wonder why.
Well, people didn't used to have clothes the way we do now. I mean, you had in the 1800s, what you had, unless you were wealthy, you maybe had four or five out dresses.
Right. That's so true. Clothes were not sort of for fashion. They were more for function.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I always had this image, you know, when I see a beautiful old house, like I went down to Fort Madison last fall, which is a river town here in Iowa, and it's one of the older towns probably, and they're these beautiful old houses, and some of them look like they could, you know, use some work, and I always think, oh, wouldn't it be cool to just go in and just totally renovate this, and then I'm like, no.
Big project.
And Larissa didn't really get she didn't have too much go wrong in her renovation.
Yeah, no. I mean, and also she had Jack, so there's this character, Jack, who's been the longtime caretaker of the house. And he's well-versed in what to do and how to renovate, and he's really leading the charge. So for her, it's not too much. It's more, initially she thinks she's going to sell the house. So, well, you know,
we'll see what happens.
Yeah, but I found her aunt, Ursula, to be a really interesting character. And
so
she did when Jack and Harlan were children, even, or, you know, youngsters at the tea parties and stuff. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, no, thank you. So I've been really blessed in my life to have some wonderful female characters, you know, my two grandmothers and two of my great aunts and even just some sort of family friends who were just really interesting, kind of funny, whimsical people. And I really drew on them for the character of Aunt Ursula. And, you know, the scene to which you're referring to, there's sort of a flashback scene where Larissa and her cousins dress up for the wedding of Prince Charles and Lady Diana. And this is a really fun scene from Phina Wright, as I drew directly on personal experience. My grandmother was a huge fan of the royal family, and indeed for that royal wedding, she orchestrated a sleepover with me and my sister and my cousin, and we dressed up with old curtains as veils and cardboard crowns so that, you know, we could look like the bride, and we watched Princess Diana emerge from the carriage and, you know, walk down the aisle, so, yeah.
And that scene is in the book, too.
Yes, that scene is in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
Even though Aunt Ursula is not alive during the action of the book, her character is really omnipresent for the book.
Yes, all the way through, really, because mm-hmm. of the history of Jack and being the caretaker and him being so fond of her, and yeah, so that's, she's definitely there.
Exactly.
Now, Larissa's mother, as you mentioned, has dementia, and that's really a main point in the book. It's a very important aspect of what's going on. Did you know much about the progression of dementia when you started writing this, or was this something you had personal experience with? I mean, obviously not personal, but.
Right. Yeah, no, it's a great question. So I did not have personal experience with dementia. And so it was something that I needed to research. And, you know, initially in the book, I actually referred to her dementia as Alzheimer's instead of just sort of more of a general dementia. You know, Alzheimer's is obviously a specific kind of dementia. But dementia in general can be caused by many different diseases, although Alzheimer's is the one, of course, that people think of. And then, you know, I realized after, you know, I think my first draft of the book that although dementia, as you say, is the mother's illness is a very, very key part of the book, I wanted to explore Larissa's reaction to her mother's illness rather than the mother's direct experience with the illness. And for that reason, and because I didn't feel like I was quite enough expert in Alzheimer's and I didn't have direct experience, I kind of felt like it would be better to refer to it as general dementia rather than Alzheimer's. So, but I did do quite a bit of research, and there's a lot out there to learn. Yeah, I learned a lot, really.
Oh, I bet. Now, Mom, you have had some experience with your own mother.
Yes.
Suffering from dementia and other members of your family. So how did you feel reading this book? You know, did it take you back to some of those times?
Yes, although my mother didn't have quite the same type. She has what they call senile dementia. And so it's a little bit different. But, I wrote a little piece to her, a little thing to her. She prayed a lot. And so I like to imagine that even in her, she couldn't communicate, talk, or, you know, visit with you. But I felt like she prayed in that faithful mind somewhere she prayed. And so that was a comfort to me.
Yeah, one of the things that I remember was that some of the things that she said and did when she was still, you know, before she got to the point where she wasn't communicating at all, were not consistent with the woman she had been, you know, the grandmother that I had known all my life.
Mm-hmm.
And you certainly describe that in The Little French Bridal Shop as well.
Yes, yes. No, it was well done, the way that you portrayed your mother, the mother of Larissa, and your father too. You know, he was the main caretaker and a very loving man, and that was very nice, I thought.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because sometimes the things that people who are suffering from dementia say and do, you're like, who is this person?
Yes. Yeah, I read a wonderful memoir recently by an author named Maya Lang called What We Carry. And she sort of discovers a whole new side of her mother that she never knew. And it's not just that her mother was acting differently, although there are moments like that too, but you know, sort of all these secrets that her mother had been harboring kind of are exposed by the dementia. But then in addition, kind of what you're talking about happens where just a different personality emerges, you know, so like mm-hmm. somebody you didn't know.
And often it's not an improvement, although sometimes it is. I have read stories of people who become, you know, who maybe were kind of not very loving or not very giving and become more so with dementia. But in Larissa's mother's case, both a more vulnerable side showed and also kind of a hostile side.
A more hostile side, right. Yeah. Yeah, there are moments where she lashes out at Larissa, and in those moments, I think Larissa is compelled to sort of examine herself a little bit.
Yeah,
like, you know. So initially,
she's not handling it very well, is she?
She's not. She's not herself. She's out of character. And Larissa is a character who really wants and likes to control her environment. So, you know, there's a moment in the book where she's describing a fight with her ex-boyfriend, and she's so angry that she takes sort of a bunch of dishes and throws them on the floor. And then in the middle of kind of this tantrum that she's having, she stops and counts to see well, do I still have enough for a dinner party of eight? You know, so she's that type of person who really wants to kind of control things. And but this disease, this awful disease, right? She doesn't have control of it. Neither of them do. And it's impacting how she's acting. And the book really is her journey to figure out, like, how am I going to face this, and how am I going to kind of return to myself? You know, she's always thought of her mother, and this is one of the lines of the book, I think, but she's always thought of a mother of one of the beacons in her life. And when one of those coordinates by which she defines herself is no longer there, then who's she? That's kind of the central question.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Jennifer Dupuis, author of The Little French Bridal Shop. Now, why did you choose that title? Because it's not, to me, not really what the book is about.
So, in full candor, I will say that my editor chose the title.
Okay.
I had a different title for the book called The Keepers. Mm. And, you know, it was thank you. It was a little bit about, you know, so there's the keeper of the house, the caretaker of the house, the caretaker of the mother, and then just a little bit of a wedding thing of, you know, she's a keeper. So I thought it resonated. But, you know, there is this shop in the book, and as I mentioned earlier, there was a shop when I was growing up in high school called French Bridals, so the title came really from the shop. And I guess, you know, it's interesting because it almost reflects, you know, Larissa's kind of engaging in all these deceptions in the book, and the title pulls you in a certain way. But I agree that the book is a surprise in that it's not maybe typically what you'd think of as a book called The Little French Bridal Shop, you know. So it doesn't take place in France. There are two scenes in the bridal shop, not a ton.
And
it's not really a romance. There's some romance in it, but it's not, I do not think of it as a romance, no.
Is it, how is it, you know, usually books are sort of identified by some, if not genre, but at least categories. So where does this fall in those categorizations?
Yeah, I mean, I would call it, I think my editors really would call it women's fiction, whatever that means, because, you know, women read widely across different genres as well. But, you know, contemporary fiction, women's fiction, yeah.
Right.
Although, you know, I think of the book as being slightly more literary than a lot of women's fiction. But again, there's a whole spectrum, right, of women's fiction. So.
Right, absolutely. Mm-hmm. As there is a whole spectrum of women writers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you have a wide variety of characters. I mean, Jack and his wife and his three his triplets, and you know, and of course your Aunt Ursula and your father and mother. So of Larissa's parents. So it was, you know, there was really a broad spectrum of characters, and each of them was looked at, and so that was good. That was really good.
Thank you.
So, Jennifer, let's talk a little bit about your writing process. We know how, like, what the inspiration for the book was, but did you know where it was going when you started writing?
Yeah, you know, so for me, this book really meshed for me from the very beginning. And I don't, you know, that doesn't happen with every project. I will say this is, I don't know, depending on how you count it, this is the third or fourth book that I've embarked on, and it's my debut novel. So I'd had some practice, but there was something about this book that I just kind of, the plot was coming to me really quickly as I started. You know, so I had the sense very, very early on that she would go into the shop and buy the dress. And then, I knew, you know, I don't want to give any spoilers away, but I knew the ending would have to involve the dress. I wasn't sure how, but I knew it would have to involve something to do with the dress and potentially getting her back into the dress. Go ahead.
And you did, and that was very, very well done, and a little unexpected, and very sweet.
Yes, that was great. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and there's a flower in the book as well, called the Night Blooming Cereus, and and so this was a flower that I knew about through my husband's family because they cultivated them, and it's a night blooming flower, and it. It basically, you could have this flower for many years, and it kind of, it's just a plant. It's kind of this gangly plant, you know, that doesn't bloom. And then one season, you know, for whatever reasons, maybe the light and the water or whatever, it blooms. And it starts, you know, it'll have a bud, and then the bud will start to open in the morning. So we had our first one open this past September. It was spectacular, although I'd seen others. I'd seen them at my mother-in-law's, but this was our first night blooming cereus. And it starts to open, you know, and then it's a little more open. And then so by, you know, 11:30 at night, it's almost fully open. And just this amazing, you know, scent. It's this white flower. It's sort of as big as like a 10-inch plate. It's big, and it infuses the room with this really wonderful kind of jasmine honey smell. But then by morning, it's gone. The bloom is wilted again, and
so
you don't
see it. So I gotta ask, did you stay up all night?
we did. You know, we have to, right? If it only blooms, you know, once every couple of years, or you don't know when it's going to bloom, you have to, right? So we filmed it too. We had a little film, and you know, so yeah.
The whole, so you filmed from the beginning, like from when it started opening to the end, and then can you do a time?
Right, you can do a time-lapse video. Yep, exactly.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. It's really cool.
That does sound really cool.
Yeah.
So, so that also was a way that you brought the book full circle, was with that flower.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Exactly.
So you mentioned that this was your, depending on how you count it, your third or fourth book. But it's your debut published novel. There's got to be a little bit of a story behind this.
Well,
like,
you know,
what happened to the others, and why, and how did you, I mean, not only is it your debut novel, but you're with a major publisher. Mm-hmm. So how did that happen?
Right. So, you know, I'm in my late 40s, and I've always wanted to write. I was an English major in college and got my honors in creative writing. And as an undergraduate in college, I started my first novel. I had no idea what I was doing. It started as a short story, and the instructor of the class said, oh, you know, you just need to write a novel. So I spent, 3 or 4 years. I think I started it when I was 19, you know, a freshman in college, and spent years. It became my thesis, you know, so I did make it into something. But I wasn't really as skilled at crafting my stories. I think I had really strong sort of writing chops, like writing description, writing imagery, but that's different than crafting a story with, you know, beginning, middle, end, a real arc to it, a real sense of kind of internal development and external plot development. And then just as I graduated from college, my mother became ill with breast cancer. So that kind of sidetracked me for a bit. I wrote another novel really quickly. So, and that's the one that I'm not sure you count that one, because it was almost like just a purge of stuff. And then the next one I worked on for just a number of years. And that one I'm actually returning to. I'd say the one that I'm returning to, it's about a young girl who's stepmother and father are expecting a baby, and it's told as a first-person narration from a 7-year-old girl, so that's a challenging perspective. And the story is set in motion when a strange man arrives at the end of the driveway and claims that the baby could be his. I worked on it for quite some time. And I got lots and lots of input. And I think I got too much input, frankly. I think what's allowed me to kind of have a reentry to it and knock on wood, the writing's going really well, is to really go back to the organic roots and kind of make it a little more fairy tale-ish and make it a little bit more kind of young from that perspective. So, but anyway, I had that project, and I sent it to the man who, Jacques de Spoelberg, who is now my agent, and it piqued his interest enough that he asked for an exclusive for a week, and he unfortunately decided to pass on that project. But he said, you know, why don't we have a call? I want to hear what else you're working on. And I had just started what would become The Little French Bridal Shop, and I had three chapters, and we talked about it, and I said, all right, well, let me finish five chapters, because I kind of knew it happened in parts, and I wanted to send him part one. And, you know, long story short, that sparked his interest, and he took me on, and he's very experienced and has been in the business for years, and he connected me to St. Martin's Press. Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things about Larissa, you know, going back to she does some really stupid things in the first
totally.
Part of the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But she has enough money that they don't harm her greatly. Mm-hmm. And so I felt really kind of relieved for her that she had this safety net. Because
mm-hmm.
otherwise this could have been a very different story.
No, that's true. And she's in a position of privilege, really. You know,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, I have to say that's something I've struggled with a little bit in, you know, almost pitching the book, or, you know, there's so many people who don't have this type of privilege, and she's, yeah, I agree with you. She makes some stupid choices, and she's acting kind of bratty, you know, in
yeah.
some ways.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why don't you read a little bit from the book for us?
Okay, great. Chapter 1. The house, a stately brick colonial, stood at the peak of a grassy hill, the slope of its great rolling lawn dotted with graceful elms and sycamores, on the easterly side of the tiny seaside town of Kent Crossing on the north shore of Massachusetts. Perched on high as it was, overlooking the beach on one side and the quiet and compact Main Street on the other, it gave the impression of omniscience, as though it were guarding something. No wonder, Larissa thought. She hadn't told anyone yet, but she'd come to prepare the house for sale. She'd taken the train up from Boston that day, Saturday, arriving early afternoon and walking with purpose through the center of town, Main Street being the only street that really constituted downtown, past Duffy's Hardware, Antonio's Italian Bakery, and Sunshine Cleaners on the left, St. John's Episcopal, Shay's Tavern, and the Little French Bridal Shop on the right, leading on to the two-pump service station just before the rise in the road that led to Elmhurst. Clutching the key the estate lawyer had sent her by FedEx, she had lingered for a moment in front of the trussed-up window of the bridal shop, taking in the puffed-up skirt and ivory satin corset of the showpiece dress, a mannequin's hand splayed out to the side, her head tilted slightly up and back in a pose of effortless elegance. "I'm never getting married," Larissa had declared before continuing on her way, suitcase in hand. She said this frankly, without bitterness. Despite the looming pressure of turning 40 the following summer, marriage was not on her mind. She hadn't had the burning desire, as some women had, she knew, to walk triumphantly down that aisle, tie that proverbial knot, fuse herself to another until death did her part. But given the fallout from her recent fight with Brent, the things she had said, those unforgivable things, her status as single did suddenly feel much more final. And now, as she approached the house, the rise and fall of its great lawn mimicking the undulating ocean beyond, she felt a tinge of sadness, a longing for things to be in alignment. But then, she reasoned, she always felt an attack of nostalgia when she came home, not to the actual childhood home she had shared with her parents, but to this, her hometown, and to the house owned until now by Aunt Ursula. She gripped the key more tightly as she stepped slowly up the sweeping drive, aware of the house peering down. The great elm for which the house was named arched up around her, its boughs gray-brown and sleek, like the curve of a woman's neck turning to look. Larissa could hear the roar and hiss of the ocean, which lay beyond the lawn to the back and left side of the house. She smelled the salty air and was reminded of her father, walking the craggy bluff overlooking the sea, its edges bordered with beech roses, their round buds and splayed leaves like royal crowns, the air around them in spring and summer always infused with that strong, sweet smell. "Rosa rugosa," he'd sing, referring to the Latin name of the shrubs. "There's no Rosa rugosa here. Who's she?" Larissa, as a small child, would giggle and skip ahead, plucking a flower, sucking in its delicious fragrance. But it wasn't spring now, and though she could smell the ocean and could feel its mist on her cheeks, she couldn't smell the beach roses. They weren't in bloom. Instead, the air smelled musty, of wet leaves tinged with the smoky ash of chimney fires. Sniffing and surveying the landscape, Larissa felt vaguely pleased, as she often did in the fall, that her auburn hair blended so nicely with the autumn leaves, their burnt orange and golden hues contrasting sharply with the clear, crisp blues of the sky. Still, the air was just a little too cool, cooler than was comfortable, causing her to hunch her shoulders beneath her camel-colored wool coat. She paused on the stoop. It felt so odd to be arriving for the first time without her great-aunt to greet her. Larissa had been back for the gathering after the funeral, of course, but the atmosphere had been different then. At age 96, Aunt Ursula had lived a very full life. She'd gone quietly in her sleep, hadn't endured months of pain and suffering, hadn't broken her hip or contracted pneumonia. And so the mood had been respectful, but not quite as somber as it might have been. There was a full turnout, the butcher, the baker, and yes, the candlestick maker, and everyone had stories to tell, either about Aunt Ursula or about not much at all. Larissa, perched on the arm of the couch next to her parents, had found it hard not to laugh at how predictably provincial it all seemed. The funeral reception had been nothing but commentary on the weather, the newly paved roads, the traffic light that had finally been put up at Four Corners. It went on for hours, the new cement subfloor being poured at the police station, the skylights cut into the roof of City Hall, the new fire hydrants installed up and down Main Street, the family of squirrels that had to be ousted from the barn attached to the Historical Society. What a ruckus they had made, squirrels being so family-oriented.
So we got a little bit of the humor and not too much into the drama yet, but that's to come.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I like the description of of the weather and just how she felt about everything. I mean, you know, I think that's good.
And that's I think why you said you felt like it was more literary than a lot of women's fiction. I think that. The way you describe things. Yeah.
I mean, I feel, you know, and this isn't a diss on other types of language, but for this particular book, it has a tone to it that it's almost a little self-mocking in a way, actually. But, the description and the cadence of the words, it's maybe more heavy on narrative and less dialogue, you know?
Yeah.
Although there is some fun dialogue too, I think.
Yes. And there are things happening. Sometimes in literary fiction, not much happens. There are actually some things happening here. Tell us a little bit about Grub Street and what is it and what does it mean to you?
Yeah. So Grub Street is a Boston writing community, and I've been a member of it since 2003, which is pretty near, well, I don't want to say this. I'm not sure quite when their inception was, but I definitely became a member early on, and they're just wonderful. So they have workshops and classes. So a workshop might be like sort of a one-day or a two-day weekend workshop on all kinds of craft areas. So, you know, creating the arc of your novel, how do you write historical fiction, working on description. But then they'll also have classes, so weeks-long classes or even year-long classes. So, six stories in 6 weeks, six essays in 6 weeks, or they have a thing called the novel incubator, which people apply to. So you have to have a full draft of a novel and then you incubate it with I think it's 12, so it's 11 other writers, so 12 total. And they, with an instructor who's leading the class, they develop these novels together, which is amazing. And then Grub Street also has an annual writing conference called Muse in the Marketplace. And, you know, I've been going for years, and the first time I went, it was maybe, you know, it was probably 200 people, and now it's, I think it's like 700 people, and it used to be really local people would come, and now it's certainly a large number of local people, and of course, when they could do it in person, and now they're doing it virtually. But it also has a draw from just across the country, and they have instructors who lead sessions, but then they also have authors who come to speak, and agents and editors who you can sign up to meet with them to, you know, there's a fee involved, but they review, I think it's like 20 pages of your manuscript and give feedback. So it means the world to me. And it's where I met my writing group and where, you know, I turned to for support and inspiration. And they're just a wonderful, wonderful presence here in Boston.
Now, you won these two awards in 2016, James Jones First Novel Competition and or semi-finalist for both of them, and the Faulkner Wisdom Competition. I'm guessing that was not with this book.
I wanted to say one of them, I entered both books. I was working on this book.
Okay.
So so for the James Jones, it was the book that I'm returning to. So, and with the Faulkner, it was this book.
Okay. And so you've been working on being a novelist for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're having some great publishing success, but how did you stick to it all this time? Was it frustrating? Did you almost give up?
Yeah, you know, so it's something I've always done and something, you know, I'll always continue to do. So from that stance, I don't think I could stop telling stories. They just sort of start to gestate with me, and then, you know, often there's sort of a gestation period where I'm jotting down images or sentences or words, or I'm kind of compiling things that are going to go into that book. It's almost if it was a collage, it's like I'm collecting little bits of the collage, you know. So from that standpoint, it's something I'd always do and would continue to do. But yes, there have been moments that have been very frustrating, particularly when you get, you know, rejection letters that say, oh, you know, the writing was just beautiful and it was vivid and I love this and that, but, you know, the story was maybe a little too quiet and I couldn't find the market for it, you know, and you think, oh my God. So as a writer, if you've been in this business long enough, you know that, you're going to get these nice rejections, and they're going to break your heart, honestly, because you feel like, no, come on, why can't you just go with it? And it's, you know, I feel really especially pleased about The Little French Bridal Shop, because it's a hard time to publish fiction. It's a really hard time. There's a lot of competition. You know, it's funny. I think 20 years ago when I started, in a way, it might have been easier had I landed the right book. And, you know, I would say, too, 20 years ago, I didn't know what I was doing from a marketplace side either, you know. I didn't seek an agent. I kind of wrote directly to editors, and really, you really ought to get an agent who can then present you to the editor. So, but, you know, my father from a very early age, we always said how persistent I was. And so you need to be persistent if you're going to succeed in this business.
And the book comes out March 9th. We're recording this ahead of that time.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you expecting? What do you think, you know, do you have some hints of what will happen?
Yeah. Yeah, so I have a book launch with a local bookstore on March 9th, so Belmont Books, and I'm going to be in conversation with a wonderful author named Marjan Kamali. We just had a walk yesterday to talk about, you know, kind of what we'll do. So that's 7 p.m. Eastern Time at Belmont Books in Belmont, Massachusetts. So that will be a really fun evening where we'll be in conversation. I'll read a little bit more from the book. I think I'm planning a different passage, so that'd be fun for listeners to hear that. And then there'll be a little Q&A after that. You know, the day of and the day after, I have been taping some podcasts, and they'll air as well. And I'm not sure when this one will air, to tell you the truth.
Around that time.
Okay, and great. We'll, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll be excited to learn. Yeah. And then, you know, the next day is my husband's 51st birthday. I'm outing him on air here, but we didn't get the celebration we wanted last year. We had been planning, and of course, we're not really even getting that celebration this year, but we're going to be celebrating both events. His birthday is March 10th, and so, yeah.
Great.
Birthday March 9th, his birthday March 10th.
I noticed on your website that there's a page about old houses, which I think is very cool. And you mentioned a couple of your favorite books about old houses, because, you know, Elmhurst is a main character in this book.
It is, for sure. Yeah.
And so what are some of your other favorite old house books?
Right. So I mentioned The Wedding Cake House in Kennebunkport, Maine. I grew up going to Maine in the summers. It's fairly common for Boston-based people. If you go away for the summer, you might go to the Cape Cod, obviously. But many people also go to Maine or New Hampshire. And there's a really cool house called the Wedding Cake House, which has this elaborate, integral lattice work, and it's just cool. So it was built by a shipbuilder. And it's just one we drove by when we were in Maine, and I loved it. Then there's another house, Manderley from Rebecca, so Daphne Du Maurier's great novel about Rebecca and the second wife in the book, and so Manderley is a big presence in that book as well. And the new Mrs. De Winter lives in the shadow of Rebecca, who is the former Mrs. De Winter, and so just a fun book. And then in this area where I live, and including actually the house in which I live, is a shingle-style house. And I just think they're fun and kind of from this region. And there's a story by Jane Goodrich. And this is an amazing story, actually. So she fell in love with this house called Cragside, which used to be in Manchester by the Sea, Massachusetts, same Manchester by the Sea as the movie fame. And she and her husband built a replica of that house. And then she wrote a novel about the original owner of that house. But the story of her building the house is a kind of enough of a story on its own, because they built it together from scratch, from the blueprints that they were able to get a hold of the old house. And they built actually a mirror image of the house because of where they were situating it on the island where they live in Maine. So, I mean, that's just crazy, right? Amazing and crazy.
Have you seen that house?
I have not, because it's on an island in Maine, and it's not easy to get to, but I've seen pictures, and I've chatted with Jane Goodrich, actually, when she did an event here in Boston. So.
Oh, how fun. Oh, fun. And then the other one that's on your website was a house that was once owned by your great-great-grandfather.
Yes. So there's a house in just outside of Boston that is now owned by the Longyear Museum, because it was purchased by Mary Baker Eddy, who was well-known as the founder of the Christian Scientist Church. My family had nothing to do with Christian Scientry. It's just that she bought the house. And so I don't know. Maybe there were sort of old houses in my blood. This house, yeah. This house, in a way, reminds me of a little bit of Elmhurst, although Elmhurst is brick, and this one's kind of a fieldstone.
I got a smile. I'm looking at Wikipedia, the link to Wikipedia about that house from your website, and it says that, according to both Mary Baker Eddy Library and the National Park Service, the main house was built in 1880 by William Arthur Dupuy, but this does not seem plausible since he was born in 1871.
Right. It does not seem plausible. I would agree. No, it was built by William Richardson Dupuy. William Arthur Dupuy the first was my great-grandfather. And then my grandfather was William Arthur Dupuy II, and my father actually is William Arthur Dupuy III. So Yeah. And what's funny is I did some research for that house several years ago because they were we had connected and they weren't sure. They didn't have – although it was rumored that the house was created by this well-known firm called Peabody & Stearns in the Boston area. They didn't know for sure, and I did some research actually at the library at Brown, and they had these old journals of Robert Peabody, who was from the firm Peabody & Stearns. And in his teeny tiny, little tiny journals that he had, there was records of, you know, going to Dupuy House today. And, you know, so there it was really cool to kind of go back and find proof of these architects working on this house. You know,
you were able to confirm that.
I was, yeah.
Well, you should update the Wikipedia article then, because it said the architects were thought to be Peabody and Stearns, but no evidence exists to prove this.
I have the evidence.
Ah,
you're right. I should add the evidence.
Very good. So, you're working on two novels now. Do you have publication dates for those?
I don't. So, I haven't sold them yet. I'm hoping to share some pages with my agent soon. And then we can present it to St. Martin's and see if they'd like to proceed. So no publication date yet. Stay tuned.
Well, we'll look forward to that. Look forward to that. And I think we're close to being out of time.
Mm-hmm.
So I just would like to ask you, what advice would you give to someone who maybe has been struggling, has been writing for years, struggling about getting published? What would be the advice you would give?
So I would say, you know, keep at it, read the classics, and find your tribe. You know, I think there are so many wonderful writers out there. And although writers are competitive by nature with each other, they're also really, really generous with their time and their skill. And, you know, they have such great insights. So find your tribe, reach out to those around you, and stay at it.
Thank you. And, Mom, do you have some closing words for us today?
Yes, this is from the book, actually. It's a quote that Jack, one of the characters, said, "In the end, we are all reliant on those around us for love, for care. Friends and family become the keepers of collective memories, memories that allow the ill and the deceased to live on." And that is so true.
Oh, I love that you shared that. You know, though this book tackles some really difficult subjects, it's ultimately a really hopeful book. And I think the line you just read really illustrates that, you know, we can find really relief in facing our vulnerabilities by connecting with those we love.
You're right.
That is a good point to end on. So I will see you all next week on Writers' Voices. And that's it for us.
That's a wrap.
Yep, that's a wrap.
Thank you both so much. It was really wonderful to spend this hour with you.
It was
wonderful for us too. I really enjoyed your book.
Oh, thank you so much.